Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the show, we welcomed Representative Attica Scott. She's the second time she's on here, but we were really excited to have her join us. She's a big name for us.
Only our oldest listeners have heard our interview with her.
Yeah, it was
from
like
early 2017.
She was our first guest ever.
Yes.
Yeah, and back in those days, we had like two microphones that we hooked up to my computers. But anyways, we were very excited to speak with her. We talked to her about the past couple of years that she's been in the legislature, how things have changed for her, how the legislature's changed, the new class, and kind of her theory of change, how to make a difference in the legislature, how we can have better bills pass and worse bills not pass. So it was a good conversation. I'm very excited to share it with you guys. But before that, Jasmine has a couple of segments about abortion, which is an ongoing issue here in Kentucky in 2019, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about that, and I'm going to update us about the really disgustingly horrible situation here in Louisville, Kentucky. Intersects a little bit with state politics, but it's such a big deal, we thought we should talk about it. And then we've got some quick hits. But without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us what we need to know about abortion.
Okay, so today I have just a few quick updates on the bills that we've already talked about. So HB 5 is the bill that would ban abortions based on race, color, disability, national origin, or sex. We talked about that last week on the podcast with Bruce and talked about how it'd be difficult to enforce that bill.
Right.
But on March 13th, the ACLU announced that they would sue to block HB 5. And this is a constitutional challenge because it would ban some abortions before viability, and so this becomes an issue under
Roe v. Wade
right. And the 14th Amendment. And they also ask for a temporary restraining order to keep the bill from going into effect, because this was a bill with an emergency clause where it would go into effect immediately, and the temporary restraining order was granted on March 20th. The other one is SB 9. We've talked about this one quite a bit on the podcast. That's the fetal heartbeat bill. On March 14th, the ACLU announced that they'd also be filing a lawsuit to stop this bill. Same thing. This is a constitutional challenge based on it violates the right to privacy that's guaranteed by the 14th Amendment and Roe v. Wade. And in their complaint, they said that this law would prohibit 90% of abortions currently performed in the state. So that's pretty crazy.
Yep.
But also not surprising, because we've talked about before that most women don't even know they're pregnant at the time a heartbeat might be able to be detected. The relief that they've requested is the same for this bill, a temporary restraining order to block the bill from going into effect because it had an emergency clause, and to declare the law unconstitutional. And the temporary restraining order in this case was granted on March 15th.
Yeah, and in case you think that this was without incident, that, you know, they filed the charge on the 14th and the temporary restraining order was granted the next day on the 15th, well, I've heard lots and lots of people have reached out to us about abortions for fetal anomalies, and a family who is in almost the exact same situation as my family, I heard they went to the clinic on the 14th and had to drive to St. Louis. They got some fundraising and everything, but yeah, they were forced to drive, you know, several hours away to get this procedure done, which takes 2 days, so, you know. It's great that it was granted, but it's too bad because, you know, you're forcing people to go to other states to get needed care. So too bad.
Exactly. Yeah. And my second abortion related story is about Planned Parenthood. So Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky filed a motion for contempt against the Bevin administration in federal court last Thursday. So a motion for contempt is alleging that someone violated a court order willfully. And so they're alleging that the Bevin administration has been wrongfully obstructing them from getting a state license to perform abortions.
Right.
Judge Stivers struck down a law that required transport agreements. So we've talked about this before. This was a law that required transport agreements between abortion clinics and hospitals, right?
Right. The idea being, you know, it's an outpatient procedure, and if they needed something inpatient, if the procedure went wrong, they would need an agreement with the hospital to go there. But that's super weird because most other ambulatory surgery centers where surgery is performed do not need to have these in place with people.
Right. And also hospitals accept any kind of emergency services, right?
The EMTALA rule, the EMTALA law forces hospitals to treat people who need it whenever they show up. So yeah, they could just drive them across the street to the UofL hospital and there you go.
Yeah, exactly. So this was, these transport agreements were a big part of the issue with Planned Parenthood being able to get a license. But Judge Stavers struck down that law. But ever since that happened, the Bevin administration has still continued to block efforts for Planned Parenthood to get their license.
Right.
So that's why they're saying that they're in contempt, that you've violated this court order that says, you know, this law is unconstitutional. The Cabinet for Health and Family Services, which would be the one granting the license, says that the decision doesn't create an exception for Planned Parenthood to get a license, which is true. This lawsuit struck down a law that was the issue with them getting the license. The lawsuit itself doesn't say you get a license. It says this law is unconstitutional. So the Cabinet's saying they still have to follow the licensing process, and they lost, and then they didn't appeal.
So what they're saying is, like, the rule is gone because the judge struck it down, but you still have to get a license, and we still have to grant it to you, and we don't grant you a license. And you can appeal that. I would assume the appeal would still be within CHFS. They're saying that basically they're just denying them a license to deny them a license.
This was just their statement saying that they still have to follow the process and that they lost, right, and then they didn't appeal, but they didn't give any reason for why they denied the license. And,
right,
you know, this is the only public statement I think that they've made about
a motion for contempt. I guess this is what you would have to do if you're like, hey, they're not following the rules, right?
Right.
And this is the relief that they are applying for. I mean, this is how you would sue, to be like, there's no reason for them to be doing this, right?
Yes, they're asking a judge to force them to comply. And I think Planned Parenthood's argument is that there weren't any other grounds left to deny us this license.
Right.
This law was why we were denied a license. There aren't any other reason we should be denied a license. And you keep putting roadblocks in our way,
mm-hmm,
purposefully and wrongfully to keep us from getting a license.
Yeah. So, I mean, that'll be very interesting to see what happens with this, because this could potentially open up several doors, because, you know, not only did Planned Parenthood want to open another clinic in Louisville, they also wanted to open one at one point in Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
So that could, I mean, that Louisville being the only place in Kentucky that provides abortion services, you know, that locks a lot of people out. And Lexington's a much closer drive for a lot of people than Louisville, if you're out in eastern Kentucky especially. So that could really help a lot of people that need those services. So, yeah, we'll see what happens there. Something to watch for sure. All right, let's talk a little bit about Louisville. You know, we tend to stick to state government. I think that that's our main thing that we want to talk about. But this is such a big story for Louisville that we definitely need to talk about it. And we've talked about it a little bit before, so we definitely need to make sure you stay updated. So back in February, we let you know about Louisville's increasing pension obligations. It meant that the city needed to send an additional $65 million to the state over the next few years. This was because of changes in the way that they calculated pension obligations. So it wasn't a change in the law. It was the change that the pension board made to make their assumptions about the growth of funds more conservative. So by that, saying that you need to put more money in up front so it can actually grow to the amount we need to pay our obligations. So that resulted in Louisville needing an extra $65 million over the next few years. And at the time, back in February, when we last talked about this story, the mayor had just unveiled two different options. The options were new revenue from tripling the insurance premium tax, or the other option was massive cuts to city services. So the next thing that happened after that, so to update you, we're updating you from then. After that, the Metro Council, the legislative arm of the government in Louisville, the Metro Council was none too happy with the options presented by the mayor. The Metro Council said that they didn't have enough time to evaluate the plans. They said that this process should have started earlier. But eventually, they did get to work. They held several town hall-style meetings, some with, you know, large groups of council members, some with just one person. There were all sorts of plans that were discussed. And then on March 7th, so early this month, Mayor Fisher's strongest allies, they basically abandoned the all-revenue plan that he originally proposed. And they put forth what they hoped would be a compromise plan. So Councilman Marcus Winkler, who actually represents a district in Far East Louisville, he originally sponsored Mayor Fisher's tripling of the premium tax. He released a new proposal which called for an increase of the premium insurance premium tax to 10% instead of 15%. So it is 5%. Mayor Fisher wanted it to be 15%, which would basically cover all of the increase in revenue. And Marcus Winkler proposed a doubling to 10%. And he also put forth a couple of other ways that they could raise some revenue. But the thing is that because the tax increase was lower, it would necessitate cuts. Now, Winkler did not give any details about what the cuts would be, and that's because the details of what needs to be cut does not need to be hammered out until the budget process, which doesn't actually start until much later. But we actually have to figure out the revenue piece now. I'm not totally sure why that is, what the rule is about this, but we cannot have any revenue increases that are passed after like the end of March. Okay. So Marcus Winkler has this new proposal for an increase in the premium tax to 10% instead of 15%, and other revenue increases, and he put it forth to the budget committee. And it did really well. It passed 7-4 out of committee, mostly along party lines. One Democrat voted against it, but because Democrats have a supermajority in the Metro Council, it still flew through 7-4. However, it was clear that the major hurdle was in the full Metro Council, where all the Republicans and a good number of Democrats remained very skeptical of any revenue increase. So that was March 14th. March 21st, 2 weeks after the compromise plan was announced and 1 week after it passed out of committee, the plan indeed failed on the floor on an 11-15 vote. It was really clear that the vote was in trouble the day of the vote. Media outlets across the city reported on a rumor that there would be an amendment to lower the tax increase even further from 10% to, you know, something like 6 or 7%. And they were going to lower that even further in order to win over some votes from some skeptical Democrats. But no amendment came. And despite the pleading of the majority of Democrats who supported the measure, the plan failed.
That's bad.
It's quite bad. So now the mayor's going to have to find $35 million to cut from this year's budget. So it's $65 million over the long run, but it's a ramp up. The $35 million cuts are what's required this year. So the mayor's budget's actually going to be released in late April, and it's going to be horrifying. I am not looking forward to looking at it. There have been some rumors as to what it will include, but the mayor's office has said that the original cuts proposal will form most of the outline of what will be cut. I encourage everybody to check out the Courier Journal article from March 26th, which is the day that we're recording this Tuesday. And that article outlines in more detail what cuts would be necessary from the mayor's original proposal. So I'm going to go over just a few of them right now. That would reduce the number of police officers by 50. Which seems like a lot to me. I don't know how many police officers we employ, but 50 police officers seems like a lot to cut. They also want to cut 4 out of the 17 community centers. They want to eliminate 4 out of the 5 community pools. They want to close 4 of the 10 golf courses, close 5 libraries in 4 years. That's really not great. Cutting support for the suburban fire department. So it's a little complicated how fire works in Louisville, but we have several small cities like Linden, where Jasmine lives, Strathmore Village, where I live, and some of them have their own fire departments. And the city itself, Metro government, supports some of these suburban fire departments, but that support would go away. They also plan to cut 4 of the fire stations that Metro Louisville actually operates themselves, cutting 4 fire stations in 4 years. They want to remove 3 ambulances from service in 4 years, and then there's tons more. Some of my least favorite ones are privatizing the zoo, or making the zoo a public-private partnership, cutting entirely funding for the Center for Neighborhoods, eliminating the Metro Council Neighborhood Development Funds, and docking the Belle of Louisville, basically not taking that thing back out on the water, which that's really sad.
Yeah, I've heard that the Middletown Library, my library, is one of the ones that they're proposing will be cut. Yeah. And another rumor that I've heard is that they would close the Louisville Metro Youth Detention Services.
Yeah, well, they would turn control over that over to the state.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what that might result in is closing that building and moving children to other facilities in the state.
Yeah.
And that could be really bad. It'd be difficult for parents and families to visit their children. It's traumatizing to children to be moved out of their city, difficult for attorneys and people involved in the court process to visit with their clients. I think that one is really bad as well. And then there's just a lot of community programs that are just going to go away.
Yeah, so you know a lot about the youth detention services, as that was pretty important to your job. I'm on the board of the Highland Community Ministries Group, which gets a lot of grants and does a lot of work with some of these community grants. And those going away, I mean, Highland actually has a pretty good budget, and you know, we're probably going to be able to survive this, but there are lots of other community ministry groups that just will literally have to stop business altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't really know exactly how this works or how it would continue to work, but one of the things that the community ministry services do is a lot of LG&E, they provide a lot of pass-through funding to have people, you know, have their electric bills paid for from, you know, basically forgiven, but they have to pass like a needs assessment test, and the community ministries group actually provide those. So cutting funding for that would basically mean that like some of this pass-through money, I don't know if it would even go. I don't know if a lot of people who would, you know, be able to deal with some of these bill forgiveness programs would even get the services, because they wouldn't get the needed help to get the means testing clearance. So, you know, there's a lot of questions up in the air, and it does not look good. And, you know, it's kind of silly to point to the boat race as something in the face of all this, but that's really sad. That's an important community event that, you know, it'd be sad to have go away.
And I don't even go to the zoo that often, but I also don't like the idea of privatizing the zoo.
No. No, not at all. I mean, cutting police officers, but I mean,
it's all bad.
It's all very bad. Okay, so Jasmine, how, you might be asking, how did this happen?
It's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. The vote worked out where Democrats basically from the center of the city voted for the proposal, while Democrats in the West End, the South End, and the East End, except for Marcus Winkler, who sponsored the proposal, voted against the 10% compromise plan. It's difficult to point to any particular reason why this happened, but in my opinion, it does appear that there is a deep distrust between some Democratic members of the Metro Council and the mayor.
And I think people were upset when this first came out around February, when we first started talking about it. Weren't members of the Metro Council upset that they didn't really know about it?
Yeah, they kind of thought that this process should have started earlier. They kind of thought that the mayor was kind of trying to get his way and not include the council in any of these decisions. But, you know, I don't know much about that. I don't know if that's real, but I don't know if the most mature, responsible decision is to just like, okay, well then let's cut everything.
Right. Do you think there's anything to say about the fact that the Democrats from like the far ends of the city didn't vote for it? Do you think there's any particular reason?
I mean, I think that says something. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I do find that very interesting. So you basically have like the center of the city, and then you have Southeast Jefferson County, which is mostly controlled by Republicans. And then, you know, Democrats have made some serious inroads in getting Democrats elected in the northeastern part of the county, really pushing out. But a lot of those Democrats voted against this revenue increase.
Mm-hmm.
But then you saw the South End and West End Democrats kind of joining in with these people. And I'm not really sure why, you know, the representatives of places like Shawnee or Shively are all in on cutting government services. It seems like, you know, those are parts of town that really struggle and don't have a lot of spending in their districts already, and cutting what's already there seems just not like something that they would benefit from. And I do think it mostly boils down to distrust of the mayor.
Okay.
After the vote, those opposing revenue increases pointed to efficiencies and cutting waste to find the $35 million. One person reached out to me after a constituent meeting with one of the Democrats who voted no on their proposal, and he and this person said, quote, "It was kind of like listening to Mark Meadows," unquote. So this was, you know, a Democratic member of the Metro Council who's, you know, I'll just tell you, it's somebody from the West End, and, you know, they compared them to Trump's budget chair, Mark Meadows, who, you know, clearly is not somebody who that person's often compared to, which it's when we're talking about making cuts and cutting government services and really cutting the fat or whatever. The people who oppose the revenue increases, I don't have any notes about this, so I'm flying blind. They had a press conference today that actually occurred at 3:30. Today is the 26th of March. And they kind of talked a little bit about why they voted no, and mostly it did boil down to distrust of the mayor and thinking that there is plenty of fat to cut out of this budget, really criticizing Mayor Fisher, calling him like a billionaire jetting in from nowhere and trying to make all these decisions for the whole community, saying, you know, he's not the CEO of Louisville. I think Brent Ackerson said, where's the businessman I voted for? It's not very coherent. And I think like a lot of people who went to this press conference was expecting them to come out with like maybe a plan that they had about how to cut this $35 million, but that didn't happen. Mostly they just had some recriminations about the mayor. So this is really bad. And there isn't much to do about it right now. The path forward is really bleak. We're going to have to cut a lot of stuff. Jasmine, I don't know. We talk about state government, sometimes local government. We try to stay out of national government politics. I don't know about even further, but if you've been following international politics over the past few years, to me, this situation feels a lot like what's going on with Brexit in the United Kingdom. Have you been following this at all?
I know about Brexit.
You know about Brexit?
Yeah.
Okay, well, basically, it boils down to these people made this grand proclamation, like, we're going to do Brexit, and it's going to be great. And then they voted for Brexit, and they're like, we don't have any idea what to do now. We have no plan whatsoever. It feels a lot like this. These leaders in Louisville are trying to take this bold stance and have no plan about what that's going to do. And it's really just going to hurt people and make our city worse, and all for not wanting to pay about $12 more per family. So
people should probably take a look at who voted against this and who their Metro Council member is, and maybe consider running for Metro Council.
Yeah, we need better Metro Council representation. If you live in a district, especially a district with a Democrat who voted against this bill, run against them. All right, Jasmine, give us the quick hits.
All right. The JCPS school board did hand over the names of the teachers who called in sick to Wayne Lewis. They decided that he did have the legal authority to ask for them, and people are upset about it.
People were upset. I saw some tweets, people cussing. They're like, the JCPS school board is cowards. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I just don't really know what
they wanted him to
do about it. But anywho.
Yeah.
Next up, last week, Bruce Maples said that HB 358, which provides pension relief for quasi-governmental agencies like college and universities, as well as health departments, he said that that was likely to get worked out. That's probably true, but some activists are getting worried that the fix will include some of the pension reforms that have been resoundingly rejected over the last few years.
Yeah, I don't know how much this is true. I don't know if it's a free conference. I haven't really been following that closely, but a lot of people started raising some alarms about HB 358 yesterday on social media, so I thought it was worth at least mentioning.
Yep. And finally, we know now that there's going to be at least one televised debate between the three Democratic contenders for governor, and that's going to be on April 30th on WDRB. So it's a little ways away, but we know that we're going to have a primary debate.
Yeah, I usually hate debates, especially like presidential debates, because I think basically people know as much as they want to about candidates already. But I think this one would be good. I think governor debates are really interesting because they bring up issues that don't get a lot of talk unless you listen to our podcast. So,
yeah.
All right, and let us listen to our interview with Attica Scott.
Representative Attica Scott serves in the Kentucky House of Representatives as a member from the 41st District. She has served in this position since defeating the incumbent Thomas Reiner in a primary and then winning an uncontested general election in 2016. We last spoke to Representative Scott back in early 2017, just as her first legislative session as an elected representative had begun. A lot has happened since then, and we're really excited to talk to her about many of the things that have happened since she's been in the legislature. So, Representative Scott, welcome back to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. If I remember correctly, this building is actually in your district. Is that right?
It is, yes.
Yeah,
it is.
So there you go. If the building could vote, it would probably vote for you.
Right.
All right, let's start by talking a little bit about the current legislative session. So your entire tenure in the House this past three sessions, your caucus, the Democratic caucus, has been in the minority.
Yes.
And plenty of bad bills that Democrats oppose have made their way to the governor's desk. You know, this recent session about abortion, I guess the session we're still inside of, about abortion, solar electricity, concealed carry, lots of other subjects. You know, is there anything beyond just like electing more progressive people to the legislature that can be done to stop bills like this from passing?
Sure. And I will start by saying that for me, being in the super minority is not new, because it is what I came into, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything differently as a legislator. So, you know, for some folks, it's a shock to the system. For me, it's, you know, what we have to work through. And I will say that besides electing progressives, we need more people to step up and speak up. So we've seen where teachers with their uprisings have been able, at least so far this session, to push back against some of the bills that would have been negative toward public education. Well, if there are folks out there who care about a woman's right to make her own reproductive health choices, they need to also storm our state capitol and make those opinions heard and clear.
So there were several bills that had bipartisan support, like the medical marijuana bill, which you made the argument did not go far enough. And, you know, you've shown a willingness to fight for the best versions of reforms. And why do you think it's so important to get beyond just good enough?
Well, it's important to get beyond just good enough because we saw that with the expungement bill this session.
Sure.
That when initially passed, the fee to apply for expungement was $500. Mm-hmm. So then we have to come back and correct that. And while it should be zero, the reality is we have to take it in steps. I mean, we can't possibly think that within just a matter of a few years that we're going to be able to go from 500 to zero. So maybe next year we'll come back and it's 125. I don't know. But what would have been best would have been zero. As a fee for applications for expungement. So I would prefer we have the bill that's the best as it relates to marijuana, and that's, for me, recreational and decriminalization, but we're not there yet. And so in 2018, I was a good team player and signed on as a co-sponsor, but I've made it clear in 2019 to the sponsor of the bill that I would not sign on because I can't go back to many of the people that I serve in District 41 and say, well, too bad for you, but hey, I signed on to this bill that you might not even benefit from.
Right.
Right, and this bill was different from the one in 2018 and just super regulated. It became a no-smoke bill, so it's a lot different than what you probably talked to them about back over a year ago.
Right. That's exactly right.
And I wanted to ask you specifically, you said, you know, people in your district might not even benefit from this, right? And I think that that's an important fact to think about when we think, oh, this is better than nothing, but maybe in your mind, it for your constituents, it's not better than nothing.
Well, it's not better than nothing. And so, you know, I know that I'm very different from many people who serve in the legislature, and my district is different than some. Representative Booker and Meeks and I have very similar districts, but our districts are very different than most of our colleagues. And so we have to keep in mind all of the folks that we serve, not just one group of people that we serve and not just the entire Commonwealth. We also have to think about being responsible to the people who often feel like they don't have any power or voice in Frankfort anyway.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your 3-year history in the legislature.
Three whole years.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really, they've been three very different years for you. Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2017, I counted it up, and I think you took three votes where you stood with fewer than five other legislatures to vote against a bill or a resolution. I guess you could say you were like a team player, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then in 2018, you took 16 votes, and many, I think there were four votes where you just voted by yourself. So at least one of them was a 99-1 vote. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested, between, you know, 2017 and 2018, what was it that changed for you that caused you to vote in that way?
So for me, it was the Brady Industries bill. Uh-huh. And I only have one regret in my votes since I've been in Frankfort, and that is the Brady Industries bill that came to us truly at the 11th hour. And the leadership of my caucus pretty much convinced us that this was a good thing to do. It's about economic development. And of course, I care about rural communities and want to see economic development in rural areas. And then we find out just, you know, months later, mm-hmm. that Brady Industries couldn't deliver on its promise and its CEO was an open racist. And so that was the one vote that I regret to this day. And I learned from that even though I do want to be a team player, that there are going to be those times where I have to say, no, I have not had a chance to thoroughly read this bill, to vet it, that no, I'm not going to vote on something that you bring to us literally at the 11th hour and say, vote for this. It's a good thing. You know, depend on me, count on me, trust me. I'm not going to do that anymore because I'd rather go back to District 41 and explain a no vote on a bad bill and even a good bill than go back and explain a yes vote on a bad bill.
Right.
So in 2019, you only voted four times with a group fewer than five other legislators. To me, it seems like the Democratic caucus might have caught up with you a little bit after the election of 2018. What do you think about some of the Democrats that are in their first year of service this year?
I'm so excited about our Democratic caucus and the way we've changed the face of it. I mean, we saw in December our Black caucus and Women's caucus join together immediately to elect the first ever African-American in leadership in our caucus. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
Right.
And only the second woman in leadership in our caucus. So my caucus has a whole lot of work still to do. And then we've seen more people who are willing to say, no on some pieces of legislation that get pushed on us or that we feel like are being forced on us, but also people who have different perspectives, different life experience, more educators. We have another woman of color, so we have a two-person woman of color caucus. And so that does make a difference, that I don't have to be the only person who is standing up as a woman of color, for example, and saying, no, you know, the folks that I represent aren't going to buy this, aren't feeling this, and I'm going to have to vote no. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about the caucus. I mean, we're majority women from Jefferson County, so that's pretty huge mm-hmm. to send that to Frankfort and to say that we're bringing that perspective. And, you know, the folks who are in our caucus who've been there for a while have to listen to us.
Sure.
And you all have also started a House Democratic Women's Caucus, right? Could you talk to us about that a little bit?
So we have a House Democratic Women's Caucus that's chaired by Representative Lisa Wilner from Jefferson County. And I'm so appreciative of them because they joined with our Black caucus to really push back against this narrative that abortions were the same as lynchings and slavery and the Holocaust. Mm-hmm, yeah. And I can't say that, you know, two or even three years ago, let alone longer than that, that would have happened, that we would have had a women's caucus that was willing to say, that, yes, we have differences of opinion on abortion, but on this we agree that it's not the same, and we can't put women on the same moral plane as Hitler.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think it maybe if we're looking at the 3 years, you know, 2017, your first year might have been one thing, and then 2018, you changed a little. But then here in 2019, the caucus changed a little to catch up with you. Would you say that's fair?
Well, not necessarily to catch up with me,
okay.
But really to catch up with the Commonwealth,
sure.
Because that's what our caucus now represents, mm-hmm. is the Commonwealth.
Absolutely. All right, so you publicly considered running for governor.
I did.
Yes, and you eventually decided against it.
Mm-hmm.
In your Facebook post where you announced your decision, you cited your daughter's imminent graduation mm-hmm. and financial reasons for opting out of the race this year. So what's the likelihood that, you know, maybe not this year, but in the future, you'll run for higher office?
Oh, I think I will definitely run for higher office. I get people encouraging me from across Kentucky all the time. They want
yeah.
me to run for everything. I feel like I'm having a Stacey Abrams moment where it's like, well, I'm just going to run for everything. But
vice president.
Right.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, seriously. You know, it's time for people to see us, especially as Black women in those kinds of leadership positions. And it's time for us to step up and say that we're going to run for them. Why not? I mean, we allow mediocre white men to run for every single office ever, but then we're not supposed to run for those very same offices, even when we're exemplary qualified for those
sure.
offices.
And when you were considering running for governor, you know, you had a lot of people maybe giving you some unsolicited advice about, you know, maybe you should run for something like auditor or like treasurer or something. But it seemed like your decision was really between running for governor or not running for anything this year. So tell us why that was the decision and why you didn't think about something different than governor.
Definitely. I have to follow my passion. I'm also following the calling of people who are asking me to serve, but also my passion. My passion isn't to be auditor or to be treasurer. That's for folks who are really committed to those positions. That's not me. So I would have just been hanging out, running for that office just because, you know, a handful of people were like, you should do it. And I'm like, no, why not, you know, get someone else to do it, especially another person of color, because there are a whole lot of us in the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and one other thing I noticed, you know, which piqued my interest and made me think that you were indeed going to run for office someday, higher office someday, is that you spent a good time traveling across the state, mm-hmm. giving speeches, meeting with citizens groups. I saw you were in, like, Mayfield earlier mm-hmm. this month, and, you know, I've seen you in Paducah and Eastern Kentucky as well. Tell us a little bit about those travels. What have you learned from those times in other cities that have surprised you about the people of Kentucky?
It has really surprised me how much love and support that I've gotten from folks across the Commonwealth. I mean, it doesn't matter where I go, Boone County, Estill County, doesn't matter. folks have been tremendously supportive. Until this day, I still have people who will say, we wish you would have ran for governor. and so that's pretty huge. But also, beyond that, to have folks like in Estill County who've come back to Frankfort to do their lobby day and to sit down with me and say, when you spoke to us, when you came to Estill County, you talked about building power across rural and urban areas. Let's talk about how we do that. And so we were able to have good conversations about how I can amplify their issues and concerns, but also how they can demystify what people think about West Louisville. Mm-hmm. So that was important for us to have that conversation, because it shouldn't just be on me, because I'm in an urban area, to be an advocate for rural areas. They can be advocates for many of the folks that I serve as well.
Absolutely.
And I do want to say that I just really appreciated when you made a statement that you were not going to run for governor, talking about financial reasons for opting out of the race, because that's something that we don't talk about a lot. And it stinks that that's something that is keeping people from running for office. And so I appreciate, the honesty about that. And it's such a huge problem that we just really need to fix and make it more accessible for other people.
I mean, we have to, and I know I share with you, Jasmine, that I appreciated all of your follow-up with being here today, because I do work full-time.
Right.
And so, for some of these candidates, they don't have to say, well, I'm on the clock and I don't get off till 5 o'clock. For many of them, they have the flexibility to be wherever, whenever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, tell us about your thoughts on this year's governor's race and any other races that are on the ballot this year.
Well, for some of the other races that are on the ballot, I'm excited that we have an African-American who's running as Commissioner of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And he decided to do that without any kind of solicitation or support from our political party of choice. And we need more people who are just going to step up and do that, because we're sometimes not going to get that encouragement
and
motivation.
I think we concede that race sometimes too.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, we don't need to get anybody
right.
in that race. It's going to go to a Republican. So.
And it's like, why do we do that? That's so self-defeating. And then, for the governor's race, I remain disappointed that none of the candidates, at least on my party side, even bothered to identify a person of color to run with them as their lieutenant governor. But yet we have letting the governor have all kinds of people of color who are running as his lieutenant governor, running mate, African-American woman first, and then now Latinx man, and we still fall short. And I'm also very clear, and I put that in my statement when I said I wasn't running for governor, that I was not going to support someone who didn't have a racial justice agenda. I'm still waiting on that racial justice agenda. I don't believe that we have to say anybody but Bevin. No, we have to say people who are going to stand up and fight for all of us across the Commonwealth, not just folks in rural areas, not just white working class folks, but all of us. Mm-hmm.
I knew that she wasn't going to dodge the question.
Did I dodge it?
No, you didn't.
Oh, okay.
But everybody else has.
Yeah, we ask everybody that question, and they're always like, everybody's great. We love everybody.
Oh, so, okay.
She's not running for statewide office
That's
this year,
true.
And most
That's
of them
true.
Are.
Yeah, I knew she wasn't going to do that. So, thank you so much for coming in, and we really appreciate the time you've taken out to speak with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page. You can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice. We also have a newsletter with Forward Kentucky that comes out every Friday that you can subscribe to at forwardky.com/email, as well as subscribe to their other wonderful newsletters. And finally, we have a Patreon page where you can support us for as little as $1 a month. That helps us with our hosting fees and just supporting what we do every week. And you can do that at patreon.com/MyOldKentuckyPodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.